Hi, I'm Scott Skelton, co-author with Jim Benson of Rod Serling's Night Gallery, An After Hours Tour, and Rod Serling's Night Gallery, The Art of Darkness. And I'm here to offer some background on the production of this episode of the series, as well as the series itself.
Tonight's stars: Geraldine Page and Leif Erikson.
About his painting for the episode, artist Tom Wright had this to say.
The ideal haunted house: dark cobwebs, creaky stairways, and your own personal ghost. Story had all the elements. So just paint, Tom. Acrylic, on masonite, with a lot of black paint.
After it dried, he etched the abundant cobwebs into the dried paint with an awl.
For example, Stairway Inspector, Cobwebs and Darkness. It's called Something in
the... One of the third season's rare successes, Something in the Woodwork is based on R. Chetwynd Hayes' Tidy Little Chiller, Housebound. Serling, faced again with interior storytelling, created an open conflict with which the characters could grapple. Instead of the lead character suffering silently in a loveless marriage and enlisting a ghost to help extract her from it, Serling brought the rift out in the open and used it. By the time Serling submitted his script to producer Jack Laird in June of 1972, he had received the news of NBC's decision to cut Night Gallery's running time for the third season. The show would no longer be an hour-long anthology. It would be reduced to a half-hour time slot, practically forcing onto it a one-story-per-episode format. He was far from pleased, and clearly saw the handwriting on the wall regarding the show's fortunes.
Yeah, it's a weekly show, starting late September, I think. You make a small man feel 5 feet tall, you know that, all of you young people? When they told me they were going to renew it, I didn't know whether to buy champagne or cut my wrist, to tell you the truth. It's a grind doing these things every week, but they do a reasonably good job of production. They're a very flashy, you know, scenic-oriented kind of studio. So I hope for some interesting things on it.
Because of this realization on Serling's part, Something in the Woodwork would be his final submission for the series. Luckily for him and us, Geraldine Page returned for her third appearance on Night Gallery to take the role of Molly Wheatland, sketching yet another vivid, memorable portrait. Director Edward Abrams, concerned about Page's hard-to-handle reputation, found her easygoing and cooperative.
She came from Broadway. I had always heard that that she ate directors up alive. I remember my first day. I said, Geraldine, I said, I'm quite new at this, but I think I know what I'm doing. And if you have any input, feel free. She says, "Oh no, you're just doing fine. I've just got to worry about my wardrobe, my makeup." And no, she was a sweetheart. I was really amazed.
Such is the quality of Paige's performance that one might be forgiven for thinking of this episode as a one-woman show. Even so, she is matched to a fine supporting cast in Leif Erikson, returning from last season's The Academy, who plays Molly's patient, long-suffering ex-husband Charlie. Paul Jenkins, as an ill-at-ease local handyman Molly hires to unlock the attic door. And a cameo by red-headed bombshell Barbara Rhodes as Charlie's uptown fiancée. Abrams, who at the time was balancing both an editing and directing career, he was the primary editor for the Night Gallery pilot, moves with confidence into this shadowy genre.
Well, I'll tell you, I was when I did that particular episode, mm-hmm. I was probably in my, maybe third year of directing. I was still what they call a teeter-totter. I was directing and editing, directing. Mm-hmm. I was still kind of feeling my oats, trying everything, looking back on that show. I remember I did a particular shot where the handyman, I remember she, at the beginning of the show, she had the handyman come in, and there was a scene in her living room where she was talking to him, and I remember he had his hand and arm on his hip, and I was shooting through his arm. In later years, I'd say, like, God, that's arty-farty, I'd never do that.
Steven Spielberg has similarly criticized his own early work and the tendency for young directors to take chances with film grammar, for which they are sometimes ashamed later, is strong. This genre, however, naturally more outlandish, welcomes this kind of cinematic expression as appropriate to achieving its end, the creation in a supposedly day-to-day experience of a slightly akimbo atmosphere. Abrams does so here with genuine flair. His sensational use of handheld camera to crawl along the woodwork in the attic is unsettling and effective, and his other visuals suggest an intolerance toward the wholly conventional setups that mark the industry hack.
Jamie Dillman, and he had robbed a bank downtown. And he tried to get away, got as far as this house.
Paige had by this time gained fame for her versatility on the stage and established a reputation for choosiness in accepting roles in film. Not for her were the ingenue roles or glittery star parts. Noted primarily for her interpretations of the heroines of Tennessee Williams' plays, she found greater satisfaction in playing broken, compromised women who've endured troubled lives. Her commitment to choosing challenging roles became her hallmark. Quote, "Everyone in the beginning of my career would say to me, 'What dreadful people you play.' I'd ask, 'What kind of people do you want to see on the stage?' And they'd say, 'Nice, normal people like we know.' Well, it sure would deplete dramatic literature if we only played nice, normal people. But the point is, we wouldn't want to know the people we go to see on the stage. How would you like to have Medea for dinner, or Macbeth slurping your soup, or Oedipus with his bloody blind eyes dripping all over your tablecloth? One of the things that intrigued me about acting from the start was that you could be burned at the stake at St. Joan 6 times a week and not have to molder in the grave." Unquote.
Is still up there.
She had reached her mid-40s by the time Night Gallery's casting director came calling, accepting roles of the most eccentric and disturbing type. The neurotic housewife unraveling at her husband's death threats and Stop Killing Me. The hunger-ravaged farm woman sacrificing her son to save her husband in The Sins of the Fathers. The lonely alcoholic seeking spectral vengeance against her ex-husband in Something in the Woodwork. Meaty, brilliantly limbed character studies of the same quality she chose for her film and Broadway careers, roles she attacked with gusto. Born into a modest household in Kirksville, Missouri, Geraldine Page had early aspirations of becoming a pianist or visual artist, but at 17 she appeared in her first amateur theater production. From that point, she never wavered from her desire to be a professional actress. She attended the Goodman School of Drama in Chicago, and later studied at the Herbert Berghoff School and the American Theater Wing Drama School in New York City. She and others organized their own acting company at Lake Zurich outside of Chicago, and for several years she spent her summers as a stock actress at Lake Zurich and her winters in New York City, looking for a role in a major production. Quote, "In dramatic school I was so tall, I always wound up being the maiden aunt or grandmother, and I really enjoyed it so much that I began to ask myself, am I really enjoying this, or am I simply rationalizing? Am I not really hurt because I'm not the one who gets kissed every other scene? Then I got to play one or two pretty young things in the theater, and it was boring. You can't do much with those parts. The young characters haven't had the experience that makes them intriguing and interesting and colorful." Unquote. Her breakthrough came in 1952. When director Jose Quintero gave Page the lead role in Tennessee Williams' play Summer and Smoke, both a critical and popular success. Page realized her dream of becoming a Broadway leading lady in 1953, the same year she was cast in her first starring film role in Hondo, opposite John Wayne. Her stage appearances continued in such productions as André Gide's The Immoralist, The Rainmaker, Separate Tables, Williams' Sweet Bird of Youth, and Eugene O'Neill's Strange Interlude. In cinema, she repeated her stage roles in the film versions of both Summer and Smoke and Sweet Bird of Youth, her first of 8 Academy Award nods. With her husband, actor Rip Torn, she co-founded the repertory company Stock Theater. She also worked in television, winning 2 Emmy Awards for her performances in Truman Capote's touching remembrances of his childhood, A Christmas Memory, and The Thanksgiving Visitor. Around the same period as her guest shots on Night Gallery, she accepted a role very similar in tone, starring with Clint Eastwood in director Don Siegel's production of The Beguiled, a Southern Gothic with a distinctly Gallery-esque twist. So what do you owe her? Thank goodness I'm a terribly complicated, complex lady, she said of her role, portraying a Civil War-era spinster who turns her plantation into a girls' school. The fun begins when one of her pupils discovers wounded Union soldier Eastwood in the woods nearby. Quote, her grandfather's plantation was going great until the war, but now everyone's gone. In order to survive, she opens the school, but there's no food, and she's the only one left with a pair of shoes. Unquote. The drama's excruciating central episode arrives with throat-clutching echoes of a much shorter gallery tale, Marmalade Wine. Although Paige never inconceivably won a Tony Award, she finally won an Academy Award for Best Actress for her achingly poignant performance as yet another troubled Southern lady in the 1985 road movie drama The Trip to Bountiful.
It's an antique.
As an actress, Paige was respected throughout the acting community for her intuitiveness and creativity in capturing her often vulnerable, eccentric characters. She died as she lived in 1987, while acting on Broadway in Blithe Spirit, a trooper to the end. She was 62.
About my baking?
No, I can't stay, Molly. I thought you said you had something you wanted to talk about.
Well, that was part of
this was the last Serling script to be produced for the series before its cancellation. And despite its excellence of execution, it seems unlikely that he ever viewed it. Disgusted with his lack of control over production aspects of the series, along with the instances in which he had unknowingly been rewritten, he had stopped watching the series around the midpoint of the second season. He was fairly vocal in the press and elsewhere about his disappointment in the show that bore his name. Students at his lectures on writing for film often praised the series, but Serling would be quick to vent his spleen about the other issues he wrestled with.
One of the problems with the Night Gallery, there was nothing typical about it. It varied too much. It had no sense of thrust. They would stick in one-minute Borscht Belt blackouts in the middle of these shows as humor, which I found uniquely unfunny. And of course I was persona non grata throughout the entire experience. They didn't like me, and they let me know. Like, they never answered my phone calls. I got a sense of what they meant. But Twilight Zone, of course, was essentially more of the fantasy science fiction ilk. And we dabbled more in the unrealistic and that kind of thing.
But while Rod was no longer paying attention to Night Gallery broadcasts, a flurry of activity was going on behind the scenes at the network as programming executives scrambled to interpret the meaning of a recent viewing trend. Propelled by the popularity of Rod Serling's Night Gallery, suddenly TV horror was, for the first time, all the rage. In addition to the success of Gallery, ABC had just scored a phenomenal triumph with its TV movie, The Night Stalker. Starring Darren McGavin as intrepid reporter Carl Kolchak, the horror thriller racked up the largest rating in the history of made-for-TV films on the night of its premiere. TV critics immediately took notice, and a media blitz ensued. Journalists marveled at the trend that America was not only embracing TV anthologies, but also a genre heretofore deemed lowbrow and beneath the dignity of traditional television programming, as articulated by Rick Dubrow of the United Press International Wire Service. Quote, Rod Serling's Night Gallery is not only doing well as an anthology entry, anthologies used to be considered ratings poison, but it is even a rather extreme type of anthology, being divided into several major segments per weekly hour. Night Gallery seems definitely to be a forerunner of what insiders are saying will be one of television's major trends, tales with a rather otherworldly and occult flavor. They are already turning up on a steady basis on the networks, and video couldn't be happier than to find another trend that allows it to escape from dealing with reality. Unquote. NBC embarked on an ambitious scheme to drench their upcoming season in as much blood-soaked rating success as possible, one of which was a new occult series for their 1972-73 season, Ghost Story, created by horror master William Castle. However, NBC had put itself in a bind by adding Ghost Story, a one-hour show, to their new season lineup. In 1971, the FCC passed the primetime access rule. Concerned that the networks were dominating the programming schedule, this decision dictated that the networks return a certain number of hours to local independent stations. Suddenly, primetime slots were at a premium, and room had to be made for a show like Ghost Story. With limited options and despite the stability of their network schedule, NBC settled on a drastic solution by upending the lineup of shows on three evenings during the week. One of those moves meant taking their Wednesday night lineup of the NBC Mystery Movie and Night Gallery and moving them to Sunday nights. But because of the limited hours available on its Sunday night schedule because of the new FCC ruling, the time slot on Sunday had shrunk compared to Wednesday. And something had to give. Given Night Gallery's multi-segment episode structure, which had led to some massive financial overruns, Serling's series was the most likely candidate to receive a half-hour haircut. Back to the episode at hand. For Something in the Woodwork, to create the impression of Jamie Dillman's ghost, which you'll see in a bit, Abrams and cinematographer Lloyd Ahern Sr. used a tilted pane of reflective glass in front of the lens to catch the reflection of the actor positioned offstage. To make him vanish, the glass was simply tipped slightly and poof, no Jamie. The actor's unusual costuming and makeup, a black body stocking, his face painted half black, half white, completed the illusion of the spirit's disembodied head floating in the cobwebbed nooks of the attic.
Can you touch? Can you?
Okay, continuing with NBC's sabotage of Night Gallery. So, not only did Gallery lose its prime Wednesday night time slot, it lost half its running time and half its budget. The network's second move, according to Serling, was changing the season focus from its diversified approach, a mix of science fiction, fantasy, occult, and atmosphere-drenched gothic tales, to a more action and suspense bent. Universal executives, eager to gain the series pickup, didn't fight the network on it. "I'm fucking furious," raged Serling. "These people are taking what could have been a good series and are so commercializing it, it's not going to be commercial. They don't want to compete against Mannix in terms of contrast, but similarity. It's their feeling that it requires goosing up with audience-grabbing attention the first 30 seconds and considerable action, as opposed to anything insightful, cerebral, or sensitive. And consequently, we're running scared. We've been cut to a half hour, which is sort of like the kiss of death. And if not death, more of a moratorium of a sort. The fortunes of the show are that it has been, at the moment, renewed for 15 weeks, and then will likely change its complexion considerably. It will be mostly suspense now." Unquote. The widely diverging ideas held by Serling, Laird, the network, and the studio over Night Gallery's true focus reached the point of schism in the third season, and Serling, without contractual control, had the least influence over the outcome. In addition to the lack of input, the rewrites, the time slot reduction, and the network's suggested shift toward action, Serling began to see a number of his scripts rejected. His sensitive study of a father dealing with his son's death, The View of Whatever, had the potential to be another They're Tearing Down Tim Riley's Bar. Serling submitted it in early February of 1972. The script went as far as being accepted by Laird and was typed and bound by Universal before it fell victim to the network's new focus. This offense amounted to the last straw. On May 22, 1972, the day production began on the third season of Night Gallery, Serling drafted a letter to Universal's Norman Glenn in a bid to have his name removed from the show entirely. Quote, "Pique and irascibility do not motivate this letter, rather deep-rooted and quiet resignation of the fact that Night Gallery has ceased being Rod Serling's Night Gallery. On the basis of NBC's new dictum, it begins to take on the earmarks of a kind of Mannix with supernatural trappings. The network's insistence on early grabbing may be a valid requirement, but I find it occasionally repressive and frequently destructive in terms of story ideas. Some of our most successful and qualitative shows, The Messiah on Mott Street and Their Tearing Down Tim Riley's Bar, gave the series some distinction. Now I find that The View of Whatever has been rejected, as well as another script I've just turned in called Finnegan's Flight, unacceptable because they don't grab on the first page. I wanted a series with distinction, with episodes that said something. I have no interest in a series which is purely and uniquely suspenseful, but totally uncommentative on anything. So, with Universal's permission, I do not intend to submit any further scripts now or in the future. I will continue hosting if you want me to, but would have no objections to someone else taking over the job. And further, no objections to a title change, allowing it to be someone else's Night Gallery. If this entails contractual problems or alterations, Bob Broder at IFA will be able to represent me and my interests." Unquote. But Universal executives had sold Night Gallery to NBC on the strength of Rod Serling's prestigious Twilight Zone status and were unwilling to let him go. In their view, his level of involvement in the show was unimportant alongside the continued use of his powerful image. A reluctant Serling, contract-bound, was reduced to shilling for the network. It seems clear the network was preparing itself for Night Gallery's failure. Commenting on the series' new certain death time slot, NBC executives predicted that Night Gallery's ratings at the start of the 1972-73 season would be anemic because of the ABC Sunday night movie, but that the movie audience would eventually die down. But it never got a chance to recover. It was canceled 7 weeks into the third season. Needless to say, Rod Serling had burned out on the series long before it ended its run. Night Gallery proved to be the most frustrating working experience of his career, and what vexed Serling most was the total powerlessness he felt during the run of Night Gallery.
I had no say at all in the choice of scripts. None, nothing, nothing at all. They would do me the goodness of sending me the script. The first year I wrote quite a few of them. And then as the time went on, they would reject almost everything I wrote. They would do it in nice ways, because they said they didn't do them. Gee, I wrote such lovely things for the show, too. I thought they were lovely. But it was their way of saying, we're boss, you're not. You're not the creative force in the show, we are. And they paid me for the scripts, mind you. I was always paid for them. But I was quietly aced out. And then I was furious because I was watching such shit on the show, which was considered related to me. And I thought, that's not fair. I may be right or wrong in my judgment of the show, but don't make it appear like it's my show.
There is little doubt that his painful experiences behind the scenes may have colored his view of the series. The quick-tempered Serling saw Night Gallery through the prism of his perceived humiliation by those in control of the show. He would naturally be predisposed against admitting it had any quality, regardless of the fact that he was, on many occasions, well interpreted by it. Serling's daughter Anne weighs in on this issue, discussing her father's conflicted and ambivalent feelings about the series as a whole.
I recall some trepidation that he was concerned that the series might be compared to The Twilight Zone, but I would say the overriding emotion was he was really excited. I think my father was confident that there would be more episodes like they're tearing down Jim Reilly's bar and that he'd be able to write the type of script that he wanted to write. But unlike The Twilight Zone, he didn't have creative control on the show, and it became a real bone of contention. And ultimately, it turned out to be a show with these little horror vignettes, which he found so appalling. But, you know, for instance, the script, They're Tearing Down Jim Reilly's Bar, on Night Gallery, was a beautiful script. And there were other really lovely scripts that he was very pleased about. And so that portion of the Night Gallery, he was happy about.
If you remove from the equation the fury Serling felt, having his name plastered onto a series over which he had no creative control, it seems, as his daughter suggests, that his judgment of the show's quality was actually more even-handed and just.
Well, I said I was, by and large, unhappy with some of the Night Galleries. I don't think they're consistent, that's all. That's what I meant. I think there's some good shows on. I think that we've had some dandies. And conversely, I think, you know, we strike out frequently. If indeed I had total prerogative and can do anything I wanted, I think I'd dabble in some of the, much more of the H.P. Lovecraft stuff, the classic horror tale. I'd try to do things with some social comment.
Serling had hoped to create a series that was an extension of The Twilight Zone. Laird had taken the idea and run in a different direction, making Night Gallery a showcase for mood and aesthetics. Serling had wanted a strong moral focus. Laird, however, was never interested in polemics. The inevitable comparisons between The Twilight Zone and Night Gallery gave some critics the impression that Night Gallery was soft-centered and insubstantial. But the model for the series, from Laird's point of view, was closer to the pure entertainment of Thriller or Alfred Hitchcock Presents. All the Zone episodes had a collective similarity of purpose to instruct. Laird, though not opposed to moral tales, wanted the individual stories to stand on their own, distinct from each other and from an imposed series style. This deliberate diversity made Night Gallery far less cohesive and, for some, less satisfying than The Twilight Zone. But judges Laird intended, as a diverse mini-film festival of motley and macabre shorts, we can come to a much fairer overall view of the series.
Where is Charlie?
He's in the attic room, moving around. getting used to things. Why couldn't you leave me alone? There was peace in the woodwork. Peace.
Thanks for listening to this commentary. At the time of this taping, the second edition of my book, Rod Serling's Night Gallery, an after-hours tour, co-authored with Jim Benson, is set for release sometime in fall of 2022. Massively expanded and researched, fully illustrated with color and black and white photos, and more than twice its original length, it's for all practical purposes an entirely new book. For fans of the series, of Rod Serling, and of television history, we feel it's a must-read. We hope you take a look at it.